Welcome to another edition of Father Time. I'm joined, as always, by my producer, Mr. Andy Lerner.
How are you?
Still no kids?
Not that I know of.
That's why you're the voice of reason. We have a fantastic show today. Our guest is a well-known atheist.
Oh, dear.
Skeptic.
Oh, no.
Best-selling author.
Oh, good.
And one half of a very famous duo.
I used to be much more than half.
Yeah, I feel way. Like the
now I'm just about half.
I feel like you're 75% of Penn and Teller. The longest running headliners to play in the same Vegas hotel at 16 years running, and stars of the hit show Fool Us on the CW.
Penn and Teller Fool Us is the actual name of the
Penn
show.
And Teller Fool yeah. Us. That's Andy's. That's Andy's.
Penn and Teller's Fool Us.
Penn and Teller's Fool Us.
Penn and Teller bullshits. Penn and Teller Fool Us.
I want to see how many times we can say it.
They're like John Carpenter. They make sure they put their name. It's like John Carpenter's Halloween. It's Penn and Teller's Fool Us. That's you make more money that way.
Whose Fool Us is it, Jamie?
Penn and Teller's. But I feel like it's mostly Penn's and just mildly Teller's.
It's Penn and Teller. Fool Us, by the way, abbreviates to FU. And we had a show called Bullshit.
We that was my favorite.
Very clear in our titles what we're doing.
I still quote you guys to my wife about organic food, and she doesn't care. She still gets organic food all the time.
She has plenty of money. And she also wants to bring the third world to its knees.
Well, it's funny because she'll go to Trader Joe's, which is the cheapy store, but then she'll get Trader Joe's Organic, which always seems really suspect.
Is Trader Joe's a cheapy store? I thought like Publix and Stop and Shop.
Well, John's is like the cheap Vons, but Trader Joe's is...
John's?
John's is a John's, which is like Vons.
But see, you know how they all made fun of Bush for being out of touch, not knowing what a gallon of milk costs? Not even a clue. I could probably get you the order of magnitude.
So in Price is Right, they'd be like, how much for this washer dryer? And you'd be like, $52.
I'd be talking to Glenn.
Talk to Glenn. He's in the back somewhere.
He'll tell you. Someone will write you a check.
I almost got through the bio. His latest best-selling book, Presto, How I Made 100 Pounds Disappear and Other Magical Tales, will be out in paperback June 6th. Please welcome Mr. Penn Jillette.
I guess paperbacks aren't anything anymore. By the way, this is also Penn Sunday School.
It's Penn Sunday School.
Simultaneously.
This
is Penn Sunday School.
Do you want to do another intro?
No.
This could do
be
it.
A, mostly parenting. I don't do the intro on Penn Sunday. I just go here. Preaching love in another place.
You sing.
This is Penn Sunday School. That's all we need. And where are we now?
We're here in Studio City, California.
Studio City, California.
Yeah, Studio City, California.
Looking at a Murphy bit.
And we still have the long-suffering Glenn with us.
Do you often not know where you are?
I never know where I am. When I was on the road, there was a period of time when I didn't live anywhere. A few things were true about me. One was with my business manager, I was the one who spent the least of all of his clients. I spent the least. And that's no longer true. Families change that.
Yes, we'll talk about
that. I still think I may not spend much money, but the Gillettes.
We are very similar.
The Gillettes are, I think we've just beaten Wales in our importing of goods.
We have Amazon boxes every day. Our carbon footprint's horrible.
Not even delivered. They come in cars now. There's not even like mail service. It's not like they get a car and say, you wanted a Seltzer machine. Boom, here it is in 2 hours.
And it came by drone.
And no drones yet.
No, they're coming.
They do like Lyft drivers and stuff.
Yeah, that's right. It's just some dude. And it's usually like 10:30 at night. The doorbell rings and we freak out. And then it's some guy who's delivering a new bathing suit for my wife.
Yeah,
creepy.
That she needs at 10:30 in the evening.
She does, yeah. She likes it. And then she'll try it on for an hour or two and go, how does this look? And I go, it's like the other 18 bathing suits you
have. And then she'll call it in and say, get the Uber driver and see what he thinks.
That's it. And then
how's my
he
ass
comes
look?
In and he's, and then now they're dating.
It's a
dating.
New ass for him. So he's looking at it thinking, sure.
Honestly, it would be great. I wouldn't mind time sharing a wife.
And I didn't live anywhere either. You time sharing a wife. Yeah.
It would be great.
Well, they say, and I believe they're wise, they, as they always are, they say, if it floats, flies, eats, or fucks, rent it, don't buy it. really wise advice. Do you know anybody who owns a horse, a boat, or an airplane who's happy with that?
No. That's the old thing. It's like the best day of your life is the day you buy the boat and the day you sell the boat.
Yep, two best days.
The worst, the worst. Yeah.
So
you never lived. You don't live anywhere. Really.
I used to not live anywhere. I used to have
a PO box somewhere.
I had a storage we had an office for Penn and Teller. Yeah. Then I had a storage space in New York. And I stayed in hotels or with friends.
Was this long? This was before the Vegas show, where you were just constantly on the road.
Yeah. I was just constantly on the road, and in between, if I had a little bit of time, I, you know, to decide where I wanted to be and visit. I believe that Keanu Reeves and Steven Wright are still like that, and a lot of porn people.
Yes. Well, they live in this valley.
But I mean, essentially, in my heart, I'm still. I'm just carny trash. I love being on the road. Billy Gibbons, Keith Richards, me are the only three people who
I
truly
would see
like
that
being
show.
On the road.
That would be
I
awesome.
Believe that's going to be the final band. That's all that'll be left standing. Two guitars and bass. Don't need drums.
No, and vocals no. at that point are just...
John Hartford didn't have drums. Lou Reed, one incarnation of the Lou Reed traveling show, had no drums. I'm always interested by bands without drums. Strong bass player, no drums.
Yeah. You know,
a jazz trio without drums. There's been a few of them. They've been guitar, bass, and piano. Nutty setup for a jazz trio.
Dylan uses drums.
Dylan does use drums, so the drums are okay with me.
You don't have to fight the drummer then to get the chicks.
No one has to fight the drummer to get the
No. You know that I read somewhere that that's why Charlie Parker he was originally a drummer and he turned to the saxophone because it took him so much time to put the drum kit away that all the hot chicks were taken by
that. That's just not true.
It felt like Charlie Parker, a great story though.
I
knew he'd be like, "Wait, here's the real story about Charlie Parker."
Charlie Parker has the story that's usually told about Charlie Parker that doesn't involve hard drugs. There's a couple of stories about
Charlie
Parker.
Only two, I think. It's the tops two.
One of them is that Charlie Parker, and this is one of these inspirational stories, showed up at like 15 or 16 to play a jazz gig when he was young and was so terrible that they ridiculed him and humiliated him. And he went home and cried for a long time and then got to be the best sax player who ever lived at the time. And that's usually told as a story, I think, to encourage bullying.
I feel like it is. You know, well, that's the Whiplash. The story of Whiplash is he bullies the kid because he's trying to make him better.
I didn't go to see Whiplash.
It's a really good movie.
But always people like you that say it.
And there's a lot of people like me, apparently.
You know what I mean by that, don't you?
He knows exactly what he means.
Yeah. Now, the other story I like in jazz that ties in with drummers is that Charles Mingus turned a trumpet player into a drummer by punching him in the face during one of the shows and splitting his lip and destroying the embouchure so badly, broke teeth and stuff, that he became a drummer. And then later, I believe that same guy fell down the stairs or something.
Tell me he broke his hand.
And broke his arm, yeah. So I think,
he became a tap dancer after that.
I think this is one of those people that, you know, God hates.
God, I feel like there's a lot of those
there's
people.
There's a lot of them.
Yeah, those
a lot
people, of people that God hates. Definitely a lot of those people.
God just hates.
He hates a ton of people.
And we have a lot of jazz stories, if that's what you want.
The name of this show is called Jazz Time.
Yeah, Jazz Time.
And I think you're going to...
It's Father Time, which is a pun, right?
What's a pun?
Not a pun. It's a
play. Well, here's what happened. I had kids.
It doesn't sound like anything else. It's a play on words.
It is a wordplay. Yeah. Because I'm an older guy I have two little kids under the age of four, and I'm 52 years old.
Yeah, there you go. I'm an old dad too. My daughter was born when I was 50, and my son was born when I was 51.
Yeah.
So now I am 62, and you could probably figure out how old my children were if I had told you their birthday.
Shit, if you'd given me enough time to do the math.
I didn't know there was math. There's no math involved.
But you held off having children. Was it on purpose or?
Yeah, I never thought I was going to have kids or get married. And then all of a sudden in my late 40s.
That swimsuit.
Yeah, the swimsuit came out. And I'd seen swimsuits before.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I was familiar with women.
Was it a bikini swimsuit?
It was a bikini swimsuit.
Do you know what the bikini swimsuit is named after?
Bikini Island.
You know why?
Because the bombs that went off
Absolutely.
Would blow off
Bingo.
Your clothes.
Bingo.
I riff that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah! I love it.
Of course, the sentence you would say is no bikini at all. It was an atoll.
Yes.
They blew it up.
Yes.
And the designer of the bikini said that it was going to be as revolutionary as the atomic bomb.
I feel like it's even
more. So you have a B-52 haircut, hairstyle and you have a bikini and you're dealing with a totally militarized zone on that female.
Wouldn't it be great if North Korea, instead of going in the nuclear direction, just really started to push? That's my producer's phone.
Not anymore.
Yeah, playing a mellow acoustic guitar. That's what you want to think about when someone's calling.
You're one
you.
Of those guys.
I'll remember that when I call Andy from now on. I remember that it's
how soothing it is.
Yeah, soothing acoustic.
It's like a massage music.
I think I have a different one for you.
Oh, good. Do you really? You have a special one? Mm. My the lullaby I sang to my daughter when she was a child was "I Want to Be Sedated" by the Ramones.
I saw them.
She carries it around on her phone all the time.
That's how old we are. I saw them at New Hampshire College. New Hampshire College in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Okay. Are you a New England boy?
I am from Massachusetts and New Hampshire.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Winchester.
Oh, sure.
North Andover and Manchester, New Hampshire.
Oh, good.
And
We can talk like human beings here.
Yeah, fuck
we
off.
We can say room. We're in a nice room.
I have an idea about stuff.
I have an idea, too. I did an experiment about it. I had an idea to do an experiment.
The Ramones played.
It'll get any good, but I'll know by Monday.
The Ramones played for 29 minutes, and then they got off the stage. Joey Ramone passed out, and honestly, you couldn't take one more minute of their music. They were fantastic for 29 minutes, and that was the end of the show.
Yeah, you know, that's surprising, because I usually found that the Ramones kind of kicked in at 20 minutes. But I saw them
many times. They did, but those last 9 minutes were phenomenal.
Yeah. You know, I met Johnny Ramone. And do you know what bally broads are?
Bally broads, no.
Yeah. Well, it's a circus term.
Okay.
And the bally broads are the women performers, also that work out on the bally, out in front. And they do that, you know, as Springsteen sings in Wild Billy's circus song, 99, 97, 98, 99. When they would hang by one arm.
Yeah.
And they would do the flips with, you know, they'd hold one arm onto the web, which is what the rope is called, and they would spin on that one arm like 100 twirls like that, which is essentially 100 one-arm pull-ups. And there was, when I went to Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Greatest Show on Earth Clown College in Venice, Florida in 73, they showed us a movie that was probably inappropriate. I believe it was called Circus Girls, but it had a huge influence on me. It was one of those, that kind of oversaturated 60s home Technicolor 16 millimeter. I don't know what that is, but
it's like a Technicolor kind of thing.
It's got that weird grainy thing.
Yeah.
It's like a Zapruder film. It's uses evidence normally.
No, not quite Zapruder film. More saturated than that. Mm-hmm. Not as washed out. Yeah. Deep colors.
Like early porn.
But yeah, well, exactly. That's what I'm getting to. And they showed this, I guess, because they thought it would teach us more about the circus. But it was really some guy's jack-off.
Yeah.
But he had a very specific fetish, and it was these women who do the web tricks. And what they've done, you see, is they do 100 one-arm pull-ups a day with their right arm and do nothing with their left. So they have this androgynous look where the, I guess you would call the northeast of their body if you're looking from the back.
As one will.
The whole shoulder
huge
structure are just gigantic.
Right.
And I mean completely defined and very, very masculine. The left side of their body is a very 50s general woman's type body, right, with, you know, the kind of gentle musculature. And it's really astonishing. I mean, you meet them in street clothes, the women that do that, and they'd be wearing like a t-shirt. And the right arm would be, you know, doing that thing that guys wanted to do where it pushes the t-shirt arm out and the left side just hanging there like a pencil. And when I met Johnny Ramone, it's exactly like that. See, anyone can play like Johnny Ramone. Anyone can play like Johnny Ramone for 3 minutes. No one can play like Johnny Ramone for 15 minutes.
Nobody could. Your arm would fall off.
It's that up and down stuff. And he really did. I was introduced to him by Debbie Harry on a rather punky little day in New York. She said, you know, here's my friend Johnny. And even in a leather jacket on the streets of New York, you could see so clearly that his body was way, way, way out of whack. You know, there used to be a popular act. Lenny Bruce talks about it when he worked at Hubert's Museum in New York. He talks about the half-man, half-woman acts. And there have been people who've cultivated that one side of the body working out and the other side not working out. And it becomes this asymmetry becomes really, really interesting.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I want to get back to a nugget you dropped out there. Your daughter, who is 12.
Okay, 11, but she has the body of a 12-year-old.
And has a phone.
She does.
Okay. So now we can talk about parenting. Now, you have an 11-year-old daughter with a phone.
Your segues are astonishing.
Yeah, no.
He's so tight. He's called so tight. Tact.
You pulled it back on topic.
I was going to go back to the clown college in 73 that he brought up and then go, how does a kid from Massachusetts, I guess, who decides to be a juggler.
But I always knew. I always felt I was going to have children.
You did. You just were waiting, biding your time.
I was. You know, my mother was 45 when I was born. I had old parents.
I mean, I'm the same. My mom was 40. My dad was 43 when I came along.
And I, although you do get taunted about, you know, is that your grandfather?
I got it.
And you get all that. It seems like what I felt was my parents had no problems. The only problems in the family were mine. There was never any conflict. There was never any angst. I had a completely happy growing up. And I was Lorne Michaels of Saturday Night Live said that show business is one of the few jobs you can have where you're paid to think about yourself. And it's very, very dangerous.
It's really dangerous.
And I was thinking about myself, and I was on Broadway and doing all of that. And then I could just feel it. I could just feel it. Right about, my mom died the first day of 2000. Mm-hmm. And right about 2000, I got sick of caring about myself. I really got sick of it. And you could see that in even getting younger girlfriends and being drawn to people with problems that I could kind of help out. I wanted other people's problems. I didn't have that many, and I wasn't interested in the few that I had. I was done with them.
Right.
And that got me feeling ready to have children.
I went through the same thing. I felt like it was like, how many more July 4th parties could I go to? And every year was the same. I just kind of got through this thing, and all of a sudden, because I never thought I was going to have kids, and then I don't know what happened. It just clicked one day, and I was like, yeah, I was totally ready to have kids.
Well, it is important also to find the right person with whom to have children. You know, I had a lot of really important criteria that I would not bend on. I mean, I wanted atheist, skeptic, libertarian. I'm not interested in the kind of relationships where you have that constant tension. You're going to be arguing over things all the time anyway. Why not get the big things out of the way? You know, Taylor and I disagree on everything artistically, but as far as money, politics, theology, so on, we agree completely.
Okay.
And that's the same situation I have with my wife. It's a situation I kind of want to have. Although in terms of conversation and hanging out and friends, I have friends that are believers and friends that aren't skeptics and so on. But for the close circle, you want to come home to people that agree that the universe, see the universe at least some way overlaps.
So many people don't do that though, don't you think? Like kids who get young, they like some girl in school, they get married, and then they, like, one person's Jewish, the other person's Catholic. And
yeah, but those are the same.
They are totally the same.
They're just part of the
they actually are the same. I totally agree.
Just part of the Mediterranean death cults.
We just did Elf on the Shelf for Christmas, and I was like, so there's a secret being that comes and visits you to make sure you're behaving, and if you don't behave, then that little being goes and tells the big being up in the North Pole. And I go, it just feels like religion, pretty
much. Well, see, the thing is that the few people who've talked to me about parenting always put this thing on my shoulders is, you know, you're an atheist parent. And I am much more laissez-faire and tolerant than my wife. My wife is the atheist parent.
There is no God.
Absolutely.
Have fun at school.
And she is also, you know, there's no Christmas. You know, we don't do Christmas. We don't do Santa Claus. Right. There was never the lying to the children. I could have been swayed on that either way.
Sure.
But now we don't have Christmas in my household, and I have to defend it. Same as, you know, my daughter.
The kids supposed to have their friends go, come on, I know there's no God, but can I get some presents? It's the end of the year.
See, we've solved that. Much like the Christians usurped the pagan religions. Did not fight against.
What did you usurp?
We took. Oh, it was brilliant, actually. My idea. We did a thing where my mother died on New Year's Day 2000. I was very close to my mom. I'm real, real, real mama's boy, and dad. I was close to my dad too. And my mother, who was very, very wise and very, very smart, she died miserably. She died terribly in a paralyzed with full mental capacities. Kind of a nightmare we all look. Not locked in,
but
she could still talk and stuff, but not pleasant. And I would read to her on her deathbed, and I also brought her balloons, which she really, really enjoyed. She enjoyed the balloons very much. And one of the last things she said to me was she asked me if I would let the balloons go after she was dead. So my sister was still alive then, and I went out and let the balloons go for my mom. And then it became just, well, I might as well do that every New Year's Day. I might as well let a bunch of balloons go for my mom and think about all the people that we love. So we had children. New Year's Day very naturally went to, we'll do this thing to remember the people that we loved that we no longer have, which was, to my children, of course, just playing with balloons at that time. They now understand it, but at the time it was just playing with balloons. And then we will have a bunch of presents, and then we will have a feast. And
sounds
so
perfect.
It turned into exactly Christmas, except with the remembrance of people that we loved being tacked onto it. And it became a complete tradition, because I am very hung up on ritual and tradition, as many atheists are. Ritual and tradition and habit all are very, very important to me. And so my children do that. And the nice thing is, you see, the majority of the children get their gifts earlier, so we can find out what they actually liked. So when you sort of the jive presents, they don't get.
Right.
And the stuff they go, wow, this is really good. I mean, you really get a full week to process, and everything's cheaper, and there's no rushing around. It is just, it's fabulous.
Brilliant.
Brilliant.
We used to do Christmas in January, my family, because we'd all fly in. I'm one of six siblings, and we were the same. We were like, this is stupid. Why would we go at Christmas when it's the most expensive? And so we would just pick January 12th, and we'd all fly back. Cheaper.
That's when God was born.
Honestly, well, they picked December 25th. You probably know more than I do. That date was just chosen. It wasn't a pagan holiday.
I mean, it's all based around harvest, I believe.
Yeah.
It's all, you know, it's the winter solstice.
Yeah.
It's when you realize the sun's not going away forever.
Yes.
The days start getting longer again.
Right.
Oh, boy, that's a good thing to celebrate. Hey, the sun's not going away forever. Days are getting shorter and shorter. We weren't sure there. We thought we'd all move to Finland for a moment, but now, oh, hey, we're back home.
Wait, it's all coming back. Here we go.
Yes. My daughter does have an iPhone.
We're talking about something else now.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Sure. I feel like this is how conversations go, but they're so interesting. It's all right. We'll go off and then come back. So Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus.
Greatest show on earth. No longer.
No longer.
No longer.
You must be a little sad.
By the way,
your alumni.
By the way, that's up for grabs, though.
You haven't bought it yet?
Instead of Father Time, you could call it Greatest Show on Earth.
Once you go out of business, you lose your trademark?
That's probably not true. They probably have the trademark.
Somebody owns the trademark.
Yeah. Someone owns that trademark.
There it is from Glenn. Glenn knows more than us.
People who are smart, like, was it Pat Riley bought 3-peat or something or other? They buy all these little... Pat Riley trademark 3-peat. So anytime
you're talking to
who's Pat Riley?
Yeah, exactly.
Ah!
Pat Riley football,
basketball.
Still pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not bad.
You knew it was a sport. You knew it was a sport. That's good.
I knew the word. I knew it was a sport from the way you reacted.
But it was more about he trademarked words, like they're trademarking words, saying, "Listen, anytime you use this word, I'm gonna get paid."
That's just not true.
It's not true.
Didn't pay him a Penny for saying
greatest show on earth.
Three-peat?
We just said it four or five times. So
three-peat.
We owe money.
I think if you put it on a T-shirt or something, you're gonna give him some money. I don't know. Genius.
But you spend all your time enforcing. You know, there's a guy in Bob Dylan's office that just listens for Bob Dylan samples and songs. You know, there's people that do that now.
I'm sure he catches how many people a day.
They just listen. Isn't that great?
In Jeff's office?
Great job. Yeah. They just listen.
I'd want that gig. I'd take that gig.
You really enjoy Bob Dylan.
I do enjoy. I just found out that I'm going to be in London next week, and I'm going to see Bob Dylan on Tuesday night. And the back page, actually the penultimate page, but the back page is just an ad for Triplicate. The back page, what I call the back page, of the program in London is a bottom half, is a quotation from me. So the last words you read in the Bob Dylan program are Penn and Jillette. And a little quiz.
Okay.
What do Maya Angelou,
okay,
Gregory Peck, Bruce Springsteen all have in common? Their quotes are in less prominent positions in the Bob Dylan program than mine. They're going to get together a little club like that.
I saw you post that. It's pretty great.
What's the quote?
It's long. I can't do it. But it's all about, essentially revolves around me saying, if you had told me when Blood on the Tracks came out that this guy who did this record will be doing a better record in the 21st century, it would have been really hard to believe that. It goes on like that.
That's the closing quote.
You don't really have Miles Davis, Picasso, Stravinsky, Beethoven, Bach.
Late in life?
No. Starting at 19, right up through their 70s,
right,
doing really, really, really creative stuff. It's pretty rare. Yeah, I mean, Miles Davis and Bob Dylan in music kind of win for that.
Yeah.
And Picasso goes a long time. And all of them with different ideas, I guess, was what I'm also saying. Yeah. I mean,
Still here, too.
Was that?
I'm still here.
Of course you are.
You're not in your 70s yet.
Picasso, Dylan, Lerner.
I think that's the trio right
there.
Yeah,
right there. Yeah. Or you could do the Star Trek rule of threes, you know? All our greatest thinkers, Aristotle, Jefferson, Blink Blanc from the planet Wong. They always do that. It's always a rule of threes.
That's a Big Bang Theory joke.
Everything's threes.
Yeah.
Is that a Big Bang Theory joke?
It must be.
It's Eddie Gordesky's joke.
It will be.
Yeah. That makes sense.
I think Chuck Lorre is a big follower of this podcast. I think
he pulls jokes out here all the time. Who doesn't listen
Nobody
to this?
Doesn't.
Yeah, everybody. So what do you want to know here?
Where does a kid from Massachusetts in the early 70s go, you know what, I'm going to take up juggling, become a really professional juggler, and then I'm going to go join, I mean, who goes and joins a circus?
Who
comes from a happy childhood?
It's pretty simple. I loved music more than anything, and I looked at the hand I was dealt, and although I have a very good time and some decent ideas for the feeling of harmony, I don't have really good intonation. My intonation has gotten steadily better my whole life. You're not supposed to be able to improve your intonation after 45, but I did. My intonation is not bad now, but my intonation now is where I'd want it to be at 15 or 14 if I were going to be professional. There's the Guns N' Roses theory. Guns N' Roses are such a mystery to me because Guns N' Roses loved the Rolling Stones. If you love the Rolling Stones, don't start a band. The Rolling Stones are doing it. So I loved the Velvet Underground, the Mothers of Invention, Bob Dylan, the Monkees.
Mm-hmm.
I could not think of anything particularly wrong with any of those bands that I could come along and do something better. There was no need that I could fill. The Velvet Underground seemed to do the Velvet Underground just as well as you could do the Velvet Underground. Bob Dylan seemed to do Bob Dylan about as well as you could do Bob Dylan. Mothers of Invention, you know, where, I listened to Lenny Bruce all the time and George Carlin all the time and thought they were kind of doing better stuff in stand-up than I would ever do, although I was a little interested in writing stuff about that. And I kind of broke down show business. I mean, I never met anybody in show business.
You knew you wanted to be in show business, and you were like, where do I fit?
No, I didn't know I wanted to be in show business. That was a pipe dream.
Yeah.
Of maybe, I never met anybody in show. I mean, the first person I met in show business was me. I didn't know anybody. We had no live, you know, Greenfield, Massachusetts.
Sure.
No live performers ever came through right there. And when I would entertain being in show business, my dad would say, not in a mean way, but in a really inquisitive way, so you think you're Johnny Carson?
Yeah.
I mean, he just had no idea that there was other parts of show business. Why would he? You know,
I came from there. I never knew acting was a living.
No.
It seemed like this fairy tale.
A real breakthrough for me was bootlegs. When I was a child, I thought, and I still feel this, even though I know intellectually it's not true, I felt that when the Beatles did Sgt. Pepper's, they walked into the studio, right, the four of them. Mm. They talked for a few hours and said, this is what Sgt. Pepper should sound like all the way through. This is what the songs will be in this order. This is the way they will sound. This is the kazoo part. This is the piccolo trumpet part. Mm. This is the orchestra part. This is the tape loop part. Now let's put it together, guys. I thought, like Vermeer,
sure.
Like people see Vermeer, that he just had these, there was no device or anything. He just had these things in his head that he had to bring out. And then there was a record that came out called Come Back, K-U-M-B-A-C-K. And it was a Beatle bootleg of outtakes from Get Back. And I heard Paul McCartney singing out of tune.
That's so...
Which can be heard a lot more often.
When I found myself in times of trouble. And I also found them reaching around for the chord. And I found them doing guitar solos that didn't seem right for the song. And I heard them doing, Dig It in a 12-minute version that they were going to put out 2 minutes of. And I heard them messing around the studio and fighting. I'll play what you want me to play. I won't play at all. I don't care.
Yeah.
You know? And I went, wow, they're actually working on this. Once the idea, you know, genius is a word that lazy people use. Once you say the word genius, you no longer have to work, right?
Yeah.
Einstein's a genius, so why should I study math? Picasso's a genius, so why should I try to paint? Bob Dylan's a genius, so I don't have to rewrite these lyrics, you know? And these geniuses all... You know, we just found out. We just found out. No one knew. Blood on the Tracks, you know, a perfect album. I had always, and I mean right up until like 3 years ago, you know, assumed that Bob was having trouble with Sarah, and all of a sudden he had to write about what he was feeling,
yeah.
And he banged out Blood on the Tracks, you know. Early one morning, the sun was shining. I was laying in bed, and I realized he probably worked on it a bit, you know, but that kind of came, well, there was always rumors of there being one notebook of Bob Dylan's work on this. Well, it turns out now the archives are opening in Oklahoma, and Bob, you know, they've gathered together Bob's archives. There are three notebooks. Every single page, dozens of versions of every song. Every lyric crossed out, rewritten, every line. No genius.
Right.
No genius. You know, Eminem carries around a notebook. You know, hours and hours of just writing this kind of stuff.
Hard work.
Yeah. And
I think nowadays you see this because there's so much more media. But back in those days, you wouldn't see the until it was the finished product. But now there's teases.
You see work.
Absolutely. And then you didn't see work. I couldn't agree more because the first time, like I never thought I could be a stand-up because people came out so perfect. And then you get up and you have to bomb.
All the time.
A thousand times before
and,
you start
and
to
so
kill it.
I didn't think I could make it in music.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to go about comedy. But I kind of knew. And juggling at that time was not a jock thing. It was nothing you did at college. It was a circusy thing. And I thought, well, here's something I can just practice. And I've always been good at practicing. I've always enjoyed practicing. I enjoy the repetition of practicing. All the stuff people hate about practicing, I like.
Yeah, I hate that part.
Yeah. I love practice.
That's a good trait to have, by the way.
I could stand in the basement and say, can I do a three-ball juggle for 2 hours without missing? And if I can't, if I miss, I'll start again. You know, useless things. If you're actually trying to, you know, now the technology of practice has come a long way. People are better at practicing. But at brute force practicing, I'm very, very good. And I thought, well, you know, I'll get to be a very, very, very good juggler. And then I'll just go to a talent office in New York and I'll say, I'm a very good juggler. Give me a job.
Because of the huge demand for jugglers at the time.
Well, your parents like, what are you doing down there? I am juggling.
And I would, turned out that wasn't true. But I started doing shows when I was 12 or 13. And I found, this is the really the whole story of my life can be seen in this. We had a 20-minute juggling show that we would juggle for 20 minutes. And then I started doing little introductions in between. So pretty soon we were juggling for 18 minutes and I was talking for two. And I started, we started being more successful. Now it's taken 50 years.
Right.
But now when I juggle in the show, I talk for 18 and a half minutes and juggle for 30 seconds.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I found where the money was.
If you start to see comics, you do, like when you first see them, they're trying to get all the jokes out, all the jokes out. And then they go, dude, I got to do an hour. And they start to talk so slow because they just get less jokes over the hour. Just take their time.
Yeah, well, the one who does the most rapid fire jokes, and I realize this is a kind of a revelation, is I think most jokes per minute is Stephen Wright. And he does that slow style in order to conceal that.
That's fine.
Because if he actually did the jokes in a normal voice, it would be overwhelming.
Yes.
But he's doing jokes, I mean, really about
it's just
every
joke.
Nothing.
Yep.
Just bang, bang,
and
bang.
Nothing in between.
No.
There's no like words, it's a second of silence. And then he was one of the first guys I saw live in Boston.
Boy.
Young comedian special at Stitches. I was at college at BU. And I remember seeing him just going, oh my God, he was Crusher. And everyone else would come out with big energy. How's everybody doing tonight? And they'd be okay. And then he would just wander out speaking that monotonous tone.
Yeah, he used to play the Paradise a lot.
Yeah.
I had a...
just crush.
I had a woman meet me in New York City. And she said to me, I was in a cab in New York City riding down the street. And on one street corner was Stephen Wright laughing his ass off. And two corners later was Teller talking. And she said, I went, wow, this is New York.
That is New York. Yeah. That's New York. Was New York a home for you for a while?
About 10 years I lived in New Jack.
It's a great city. That's where I met my wife.
Yeah, so, in her bathing suit.
You know what's funny? Growing up in, yeah, that's all she wears now.
Oh, it's good.
Yeah, yeah. Growing up in Boston, we always were taught to hate New York. Did you feel that? They always,
I'm Western Mass. You don't know, the culture is so different.
It is different.
You know, the culture is so different. Out in Western Mass, Boston was as far away as Chicago.
Yeah.
I mean, I never got to Boston. We went to one school trip to the USS Constitution when I was in sixth grade.
I made that same trip. Everybody makes that trip.
And it was the only time.
You went to see the mothers once you
were older. But that's not as a child.
No. Okay.
I got my driver's license and a week later went to see the mothers in Boston.
I was at the Rathskeller or... Yeah.
The Rat.
The Rat was the best. I saw the Dickies at the Rat.
So you saw the Dickies?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Yeah, they were really good. That was good. Yeah,
that's a good show.
Yeah, that was a good show.
And you were probably seeing like Talking Heads and...
Yeah. Back in the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are good times.
And so you decided to have children
at 49.
And your wife is younger or older?
She
than
is
you?
Younger. She's, yeah, there's a big age gap. Are you similar in that?
No, my wife's about 10 years younger than
10
me.
Years younger.
Nine, right? Nine, is
like
it nine?
16 years to look.
Glenn, but I look over at Glenn.
You,
for
I was going to say, do you not know your
she's,
wife?
She's 51, so
11.
So she was 40.
I knew it was one off 10.
Yeah.
So I had two choices, if you're staying with integers.
It's a good thing Glenn's here.
Yeah, sure.
Thank
is.
God Glenn's here.
Oh, yeah.
The whole thing would fall apart. The names?
Well, see, this
Zoltan.
Is another thing. This
I know.
Is another
you're
thing.
You're going to have to talk about it a little bit.
My daughter's name is Moxie.
Uh-huh.
There were two choices I was pushing for. One was Moxie and one was Jill. Because I thought Jill Gillette would be really nice. I've always liked the name Robbie Robertson.
Yep.
I have a friend, Emery.
My wife married me for my last name, Kate Kaler. She's Kate Kaler. She didn't like me. She just likes the last name. I couldn't agree more with that, like, short, and then just Jill Gillette's fantastic.
Jill Gillette's be a good name. And I also thought of Gillette Gillette.
Yeah.
So she'd be called Jill Gillette, but her name would be Gillette Gillette. But moxie is an interesting word.
Yes.
It's one of the few words like Kodak that was absolutely created.
I did not know that. Was it a soda or something? It was like, get some moxie.
No. For the soda.
Oh, it was.
It was created for the soda. The guy thought the word was good. Then the word came to mean moxie. Mm. Came to mean gumption, chutzpah. We want to go to, I look at you for chutzpah. It's a purely American word, you know, like the name Revere, which Paul Revere invented to be an American name. It's an American name for chutzpah, and went into the vocabulary from there. And it was, you know, moxie was the soda that created Coca-Cola and everything else that came after it. It was a tonic. In Boston, you still, they call it tonics. And also undrinkable unless you're from New England.
No, it tastes horrible.
I love it. So we had decided that the name Moxie was a cute name, a name that was unlikely to have other children in her class with that name.
Sure.
Don't want to name her Ava.
No. But just in case you gave her a special middle name, just in case there wasn't another Moxie.
See, this is where there's that you use in that second person singular there.
I'm not good with grammar, so you're going to have to explain that.
Here you go. I have to defend the fact that her middle name is Crime Fighter.
You don't have to. I think it's the greatest thing of all time.
Not from you. Other people have to defend it. And yet,
fuck them.
I had nothing to do with it.
Okay.
I was backstage in the monkey room, which is what our green room is called, with my wife and our piano player, Jonesy. And I had just written a novel called Sock. In one of the scenes, one of the characters goes, "From now on, my name is Crime Fighter. Just call me Crime Fighter." And I said to my wife, gently, kindly, sweetly, I thought, what are we going to do for a middle name? Maybe Moxie Gillette, we feel good with. We'd already known the sex of our child. Moxie Gillette, I feel really good with, but what about the middle name? And my wife went, "Middle name? I don't even have a middle name. Middle names are stupid. I don't mean, who knows your middle name? No one knows your middle name. Middle names are stupid. I don't have one." I said, okay. She goes, "I don't care, whatever you want." And Jonesy said, "Well, why don't you name her Crime Fighter? Moxie Crime Fighter Gillette." She went, "Fine, that's the middle name. You got your middle name now."
And scene.
And scene. I love it. I love that other people will give you shit for it.
Cut to 20 years later. You know, it's entertainers like you who to put your ego on your daughter. And then I came up with the joke, which turned out to not be a joke. I said her middle name is Crime Fighter, so that when she gets pulled over by the police, she'll be able to show her license and say, "Officer, my middle name is Crime Fighter. We're on the same side."
I love it.
Twice so far, my wife has been speeding, pulled over by a police officer, shown her license, and the police officer the first time looked in the back seat and went, "Is that the little Crime Fighter? Well, she's taking care of this. You don't need me. Carry on, citizen."
Oh, that's awesome.
And then the other time, my wife actually said, "You know, that my daughter in the back seat, her name is Crime Fighter. She's watching out for us. We're okay. We don't need you, but thank you, officer." And the officer went, "Really? Your middle name is Crime Fighter?" And my wife said, "Yes." And she went, "Oh, okay, go ahead." So far.
What, two for two?
Yeah, so probably about, what's that, $600 worth of?
So at some point in her life, if she does resent it, you can just blame Jonesy.
Well, yeah.
Which is great.
I mean, maybe she'll really become a superhero of some sort.
But she hasn't regretted it yet because, what's my middle name?
I don't know.
Yeah. You know it? You don't know, do you?
I mean, I'm sure it's on Wikipedia somewhere. And
sure it is, but my point is...
I was going to ask Glenn, because he seems to know it.
What's his middle name?
Fraser.
But your business card used to have that on it.
Yeah, Penn
Fraser.
Those Gillette?
Big, giant, pink business cards.
P.F. Gillette.
But my point is that you don't need to use your middle name.
Did you get grief as a kid with the name Penn?
Yes, I was always called Penny, and they put me in the wrong gym class. And they would.
Penn's not short for anything. It's just Penn.
It's just Penn, yeah. Well, it is short for Penny, but my parents thought they were having a girl. Just thought it. There were no tests run. They just thought it. And they were going to name me after my grandmother, whose last name was Penny, which is very confusing. And they were going to name me Penny. I was going to be Penny Gillette. And then when I was a boy, I guess they thought their two choices were cut off the name or cut off the penis.
Penn's a great name.
And my mother would always try, my mother, who was a liar and a very good one, at the end of her life would do things like saying, you know, I knew this, but I just read an article the other day that Penn was actually a Viking name that they got Penny from. I said, well, where's that article, Mom? Well, I don't know. I just read it. You didn't think to cut it? Mom, you're lying. Well, yeah, I heard it somewhere.
You just call bullshit on everybody.
Yeah.
You took my Charlie Parker story, which I had read somewhere, and you're like, not a chance. Bullshit.
He probably was a drummer.
I think he did start.
I just bullied you. Just like Charlie Parker. So you'll go and study more.
And
they'll say, that's how he became the greatest jazz historian of all time.
Right. By bullying everybody into research.
Bullshit.
Bullying into research.
But you say it with such conviction that people go, shit, maybe he is right, man. Maybe he does know.
So yeah, my daughter has a middle name, which she's not complained about. She uses it when it's advantageous and does it when it's not.
Why do people feel the need to give you shit about the name you gave your kid? The same way they give, like,
because they're,
people are...
they're so sick of talking about their own pitiful, desperate lives.
They go, how can I strike down?
And then my son, his name is Zoltan.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought was from the magician side, but it's your wife's ex...
My wife's maiden name.
My wife's maiden name, yeah.
As it's called in our patriarchy. Mm-hmm, yeah. It's Zoltan, T-E-N, not D-A-N-R-O-N. It's also the name of Dracula's dog, which is important.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, and it's also Hungarian.
I'm calling bullshit on that one.
It's Hungarian. No, Dracula's dog, Zoltan. Yeah, you can check it out.
Glenn's given the nod of approval.
And... so he's called Z, but he's called Zoltan, you know, and I've always liked people with last names as first names very, very much. And his middle name, at my wife's insistence, is Penn. So he could also be Z Penn Jillette if he chose.
Z Penn Jillette.
And Zoltan is also Hungarian for king, so I can kind of consider we named him after Elvis.
That whole thing went from Dracula's dog to Elvis. I loved it. Yeah, the kid's got a lot of stories.
There's a direct line between the two of them.
There is.
Yeah, I think it's great to have. It's always a great conversation starter for the rest of their lives. They have this amazing name.
I always think that you should... I also, everybody that is named like Mike or
Bob.
Dave or Bob. Bob is a much less common name now, but Mike or Dave. All the people that are named that say it's so cruel to give your child an odd name. And yet every single person, without exception, that I know who has an odd first name, loves it.
Yeah.
I have a friend named Carr, you know, Trip, you know, Trip, what's his name from the computer stuff. All those people with those names seem to love them, just adore them.
They hate them when they're young.
Liberty? No, that's just not true.
Well, some do. Some do because they get bullied.
Give me the example.
I have a nephew, Ashley. He's a boy. His name's Ashley. And he was tortured. And he changed it to Alex. And then when he got older, he went back to Ashley.
Yeah.
Because he got bullied. People like Penny would, you know, he got beat up and he got sick of it.
Yeah, well, I used to, you know, they would call...
You were also seemed 6 foot six.
Right, but six foot seven is a
I didn't mean to take an inch away. Six seven is a
size that gets beat up more.
People do want...
You can't go wrong.
They want to challenge the king.
Especially if there's a big guy who's a complete pacifist and they know is not going to hit back.
That's right.
I could just be a punching bag.
That's in prison. They go go find the biggest guy.
You spend time in prison?
A couple times, yeah. Well, you know, my wife's got bathing suits and stuff, so it's some bad stuff happens.
Do your kids get picked on because their dad's famous?
I don't know. You know, My daughter said just the other day that her science teacher said to her out of the blue, I'd like to be as smart as your dad. To which my daughter responded, oh, he's really stupid. He does really stupid stuff. I said, so you disabused her of that. She said, yes. Irony is not the right word, but I was struck by the poetics of my daughter telling me that story yesterday in the car and then hooking up her iPhone to the stereo in the car. And playing I'm Not Famous. Where My Haters, I'm Not Famous. You know this tune?
I don't know.
It's a great, great song. A fabulous song. And the whole lyrics are, no paparazzi following me. They don't care what I do. Right. I'm not famous. Where's my haters? I don't have them. I'm not famous. And it goes on celebrating being unknown, which my daughter sang along every single word. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it's like. You know, they drive to school past, you know, two Penn and Teller billboards. Occasionally, if I go in
for, and this is in Vegas, right?
Yeah, if I go in for a parents' conference, you know, or go in when the class is there, it is not unlikely that students in the class will ask for my autograph. Mm-hmm. Now, what does that do to a child? I have no idea. I've never experienced it, and I try talking to my children about it, and that's useless because they haven't experienced anything else.
Couple quick questions to get out, right? Andy, we have a minute or two, right? These are just a couple questions we kind of wrap things up with, and you're going to be boxed into a corner a little bit.
Sure.
What is a trait that you hope your children get from you?
Kindness.
No, from you, Penn. Trait that you embody, and then they take it from you.
I would like to say kindness.
I think so. That's a good one. What's a trait you hope they don't get from you?
Too much ambition.
Yeah, I feel like you need to really take a day off or two. Really, you've made it. You won the game. And the last question is, what is a mantra that you would have your kids live their life by that maybe you've lived your life by? You've said a few things already that have kind of fallen in that vein.
It frightens me, the awful truth of how sweet life can be.
I love that so much. I'm going to let that rest. That's absolutely, that's going to be the quote. Mr. Penn Jillette, thank you so much
Thanks.
For coming. Andy Lerner, as always, thank you for having Penn come on the show. It's a real treat. And that's it for Father Time. We'll see you next time here.
Father Time.
Father Time.